I've been very preoccupied with packing, and I just have a few notes down. Rather an uneasy position to be in, because I'm posing as an authority on fornication, and that's a dubious honor or whatever. And I am no authority on that. I've had some talks with some people, and I guess since the Zorba discussions have been many of them, this is a, you know, this is a command session in a sense. We always, each year, we talk about premarital relationships, fornication, adultery, and lifestyle. We usually do that in the spring, and I always hope that it's not too late. You know, by that time, but there to talk about something so closely associated with love is very important, particularly because love is the God term of our maybe all time, but certainly our time. We do tend to think that we transpose the terms. We say we know that God is love, and then we flip it over and say love is God. And whether we say that, you know, with our mouths or not, we tend to say it with our hearts, and tend to say that all's fair in love and war, all done in the name of love, certainly must be okay, more than okay. That's, I think, an error we make. We do study the book Four Loves in the spring, the book by C.S. Lewis. It takes about, I feel, and we have some pretty sharp students, but I feel it takes about 7 months of pretty close conversation and close thinking in order to understand the weight of that word study. And that's just what that book is. We will be talking about that later this year down at Pepin. But some people wanted some talk before we left. I think that talking about premarital sex or fornication or adultery, which is, I guess, postmarital, extra, post-extramarital sex, has some problems involved, just talking about it. It's a problem that is very similar to the difficulties that talk about any of the things called the law have. First, we have a problem of courage, because it is very difficult to say that something is wrong, was not good for us or for other people, that we may have been involved in. That includes, I'm talking about all laws, from drunkenness, sexual, breaking sexual laws, whatever. It's very hard to have the courage enough to say that something that we may have done is wrong. If we haven't done it, a loved one has. We want to justify our friends, and we want to justify ourselves. That's by our nature, our old Adam nature. And so it does take a great deal of courage to look at that, look at our behavior, and then in some of that behavior recognize that indeed it was not good for us. That's related to another problem, a fear problem, because if you say that it is wrong or not good for people to do something that you have done, you are sticking your, or you're probably going to be called a hypocrite. Now, that's not valid. I think that indeed the person who should be listened to most is one who testifies against his own apparent bias, which is a basic principle of rhetoric. Reason, I mean. But we do have a fear problem. We are afraid to say that things are wrong that we have done, especially if the person knows that we've done them. And you can get into some really gruesome discussion when that happens. but it takes a great deal of courage to overcome that fear. And we have a language problem. We don't like to talk about fornication and adultery much anymore, and that isn't just outside the church, that's within the church. We have to admit, I don't think there's any way out, and that's what I meant today, or this noon, when I mentioned I might say a few things about what I think, but I do know a few things that are outside just my opinion, which I don't really devalue at all. I think my opinion is pretty solid. But I don't think any of us can not recognize that what is called, what we might like to call premarital sex, is what the Bible, the Word of God, calls fornication. And extramarital sex is called adultery. And there really isn't any way out of facing that. But we don't like those terms. Whether we have been fornicated or committed adultery or not, we probably, if we've made it past the age of 18, know a good number of people who have, and we care about those people, and we know that they aren't low-life individuals, and we associate the word fornication with real low-life, back-alley kind of things. And so we are tempted not to call what maybe our friends do fornication or adultery. We stress the necessity to be sympathetic and to understand, which is clearly a necessity, because then only if you sympathize and understand can you not condemn, and neither should be justified. And our first move that should show us that we're justifying is when we quit calling something fornication and we start calling it premarital sex, or quit calling things adultery and call it extramarital behavior or something. Now, no matter who does it, it's adultery or fornication. No matter what the guy looks like or what kind of rationale is given or how sympathetic we can be to the situation, I think, and I may be wrong here, but I think that it's very clearly going straight against what God says is good for us. Now, that brings up another problem. We tend to think that sin is essentially a matter of breaking rules or breaking laws. If we sin, it's a legal thing. It's not a legal thing. I think, and Nancy should maybe come in on this in a little bit, but I think the essence of the word sin is that what is called a sin in the New Testament and the Old Testament are those things which are not good for us. That's the point. It isn't if we break if we sin, the point isn't that we've done something illegal. The point is that we've done something against ourselves and against other people, the community, whether we can understand that or not. Whether we can understand why that isn't good for us or not, that in other words, what is sinful is not dependent on my level of ignorance. I think God saw fit to make it that way. So what is sin is not dependent on my level of ignorance. And that was very good that he did that, because at different times in my life I choose to be very ignorant. The burden of proof, I think, when we're facing our Lord and our Father in heaven, who has told us some things that are not good for us, the burden of proof isn't on him. And I think there's some wisdom, there's some other things to say about that, but there's a great deal of wisdom about that, I think. And some of it, I think, was caught in something that Corrie ten Boom said once in some book. I think it was The Hiding Place. But she was talking about how she had asked her father when she was something like 6 years old or 7 years old about what sex was and certain things about sex. And her father said, "Corrie, I will tell you later, but not now." And she said, "No, I want to know now." And he says, "Well, Corrie, if... you know that big suitcase that we have you know, that your, that the family has? Yeah, yeah, that big one. And he says, would I ask you to carry it? Well, no. What would happen if you did carry it? I'd be hurt. And he says, the answer to your question is like that. That there will be a time when this will be clear to you, but for me to answer you would be like having me ask you to carry that suitcase. And I like that. I think that our relationship to the law of God should be, in a sense, we are children of God. Sometimes our parents cannot explain to us. I get in that situation all the time with my own children. Lucy and Sam do not understand enough or have enough experience to understand my answer to certain of their questions. And so they have to trust in me, that I've lived a certain kind of life and tried to be as perceptive as I can to hand on to them as much of what is good and healthy as I can. And I think with a Father in heaven, we're in the very same situation, that we are children. And as children of God, we aren't really in a position to say, well, gee, if you can't give me reasons why I shouldn't do this thing, it's your fault. When probably God, who created our ovaries and our gonads and whatever you want to call them, knows what those things are hooked up to better than we do. Now, one other problem that we have is that in this age of incredible neurosis about sex, and any country that has it on every billboard must not be having much of it to have it advertised like that. But we have a problem, because I think just being raised in this society, we get a false sense of the size of the sex act. Sex act is a very small part of sensuality. It's a very small part of my own sexuality, which expresses itself in many, many ways. And the sex act is just one of those ways. But we have sort of, this beautiful pond, sometimes very turbulent, or you could go right to Freudian symbols and talk about geysers and things. But anyway, this act, we have made it so oceans big, and in a sense it's usurped the place of love. We've asked it to deliver what only love can. And that isn't fair to the sex act, which is indeed pleasurable and can be beautiful and meaningful too. But it isn't fair to ask too much of it. And I think that one of our problems is that we assume that it can carry more weight than it can. And then I think that I can end at least my beginning. Through these last days, I've thought of many, many different things at different times to mention, and I've forgotten most of them. And just tonight, right before I came down, I had time to jot down these, and these are some. But I do remember one thing that I did want to mention. It's really, I think, significant, and I don't know if it seems significant will seem significant to you people. But when I was married, I got a really happy surprise, a completely unexpected surprise. And that surprise was that I could have deep personal relationships with women again, besides my wife. Prior to being married, this disproportionate emphasis on sex act and sexual politics and whatever was going on, made it almost impossible to have the very kind of relationship that the sex or premarital sex is advertised as helping deliver. It made it almost impossible before I was married to get to know the individual woman. I can't think of a single case that complications didn't arise to where the expectations either on my part or the lady's part were such that somehow, darn it, the subject always changed. And I ended up having to leave a lot of relationships because I did not want to be taking what was offered, and right from the time I was 18. But it ended up leaving. Then after Elise and I were married, it was just so much fun because most of the people we knew that I was married, and happily so. That didn't get involved, and my goodness, it was so much fun to have very deep, meaningful, expressive, imaginative, intelligent, heartfelt conversations with women again. I'd forgotten what that was like. I used to have them back when I was a kid, you know, with my aunts and things like that. It was a little charmer. But anyway, now, that's very significant to me. I don't know if that's clear. And I don't know if I could explain too much more about that, why that was so. I think I can a little bit, but I don't know if that's, I think it's self-explanatory. But some of these other problems and do need some more talking. I think one difficulty we have is that we may be Christians and we realize that anytime we break any law or any at all, we've already broken the first commandment, which says, which is to love God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul and all your strength. Anytime we break even the smallest law, we've gone against broken that one. And in this particular, as Nancy reminded me, this particular fornication and adultery, because it's involved in one way or another with love, it breaks the second commandment as well, because really nothing is more quickly becomes an idol than love, unless it were myself. I mean, I become my biggest idol. But then after that, love has got to be the next one. Throw it out to discussion. I'm a little sleepy, so I don't know if I've given a coherent statement or not. I've been looking at the bricks. I'm basically shy. I know that much of what I've said sounds like I'm a fundy. but it's... I think I'm radically both two directions. So. I'm very far right and very far left. But I'm not... one other thing I was going to say is that for the purposes of an easier time discussing, let's all assume that we have telepathy and we know a very close friend who's been involved in both of these things, so that we don't have to be embarrassed about talking about these things, because and I won't ever ask anyone, how do you know, or anything like that. We all have telepathy, and we all have very good friends who've been involved in both of these things. Was there anything, Nancy, did I mention anything else today in bits and pieces that I was going to mention? Or? That's a big subject. Subjective value, I could bring that up, is that our generation has been raised with something that is a theory, and we've assumed that it was, there is such a thing as a theory of subjective value, and that's a theory that can be argued, and I think is argued sometimes, but hardly ever argued anymore. It's assumed that subjective value is the only kind of value that there is, and subjective value means that if I value this, it is valuable, and if you don't, that, and what you have to say, that really doesn't make that much difference. It's, I have my values and you have your values, and what was it I said to the lifestylers? I have my values and you have your values, and if we get together and share our values, we will have a valuable time. But there is that theory of subjective value is only a theory, and a pretty floppy one too, and C.S. Lewis in Abolition of Man talks about that very well, and he tells us again what the theory of objective value, that there really is something that is valuable in terms of human behavior, whether anyone has those same values or not. There are value statements, and 100% of the people on the planet could disagree, and it wouldn't change the validity of that a bit. But we assume that if whatever we think is valuable, and that's not logically possible. Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis can show you that very kindly, in a very kind way. But I don't want to get too much into that, because unless someone has a specific question, because it is indeed takes 18 hours of the lifestyle students each year to talk about that. They do that right in the beginning of the year. But read Abolition of Man. I was so angry when I found I made it through college with honors and departmental honors and all sorts of stuff without ever having had subjective value and objective value explained to me or been exposed to it. Especially at St. Olaf College, which was nuts, because that it's so important to be acquainted with that, the difference. Did that just muddle things, or I really can't tell what's happening. An awfully embarrassing subject, I know that.
It's a little unclear to me on what the framework is here, but this talk about currently held theories, or at least in my own mind, I think I make a distinction, and it might be for purposes of justification, between arguing a theory, say, subjective value or whatever, and its ramifications,
mm-hmm.
on one hand. On the other hand, talking about individual people and individual acts, Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned that because you said, you know, we like to be kind and generous to our friends and to ourselves and give them and ourselves benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But I really wonder if there might not be a distinction. And if so, how do we talk about it?
A distinction in that they're...
Well, when I think about ethics, trying to lay down rules and think of guidelines and conduct in that, I can imagine that whatever rule or guideline I could think of, there would be an exception. And I wouldn't want to be the one to say that everyone had to always, you know, abide by that on pain of even my own disapproval. Although at the same time, I do that all the time. I want people, you know, to behave certain ways, and I try to get them to do that if it's important enough to me. But from time to time, it's brought home to me that my principles and my guidelines are very partial. Now, you're talking about God's laws, you know, but those are interpreted by people too. And there's some gray areas in there for me.
They are. I think they're more. I think that once one starts talking in terms of ethics, there are more gray areas than well, Scripture's very point blank on certain things, and on this one, He's standing 2 feet, you know, God's standing 2 feet away from me with me, you know. You know, he gets me. I mean, they're, this isn't one of those slippery little gray things that, you know, that we chase down. This isn't a question of when is it or when isn't it or whatever. It's pretty clear that God thinks, whatever his opinions may be, that it's not good for us, for me, no matter if I want to or whatever, or how justifiable I think my case is, and the world thinks my case is. It's not good for me, if I'm single, to be having intercourse with someone else who is single. And that if I'm married, it's not good for me to be having intercourse with anyone else but my wife. Now, he just sort of lays that one right down in front of you. Now, the gray areas in this, I do see some, not gray areas, but I do see that certain forms or intensities of justification of these things are more damaging to people, I mean, you know, than other forms, perhaps. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, that I think that there are probably, you know, the destructive, non-creative element of going against these is more or less apparent, you know, at certain times in that individual. That the non-creative effect may not be seen for years. It may not even be seen in the realm of sexuality. But having done something like this, it allows me to establish this precedence that then enable me to react toward God and other people in other ways.
Yeah.
But I think to chase those down is how much destruction and how much time and so forth. That's where we start pursuing the chasing this, like we do about in ethics when we're chasing down various shades of gray. But, you know, we're in a sense talking more, I think, when we face this point-blank statement of Scripture, we're talking about various shades of black, if anything.
See, in a way, I'm arguing against myself, and I hate what I'm doing. But I'm so persistent and proud that I have to continue. I don't necessarily accept, you know, I don't necessarily accept ethical statements in the Bible as absolute. I may or I may not, and I think I'd rather come at it in the line of more what you just said, in the sense that there's a totality of relationship with God. You know, that's not found through any particular path, but is manifested in all particulars. But the particulars don't add up to that, in a sense, nor get us to it. But it's a continuing sort of thing. I mean, I've argued essentially what you've argued before.
Mm-hmm.
But
I haven't argued yet, though.
Well, you put forth a statement. I know you claim you aren't, but for instance, Paul makes other statements too that we now say was a culturally framed statement that we're no longer ready to abide by. And to me, that there's a gray area there.
We say there is.
All right. Yeah. And I have trouble with feeling like the law, you know, wants to push me into a corner, and I want to fight against that. Maybe I'm doing that now.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say something about the law. One thing, when one knows, right down to the bootstraps, that one is forgiven. When I realize that, in those moments that I realize that, or minutes, or hours, whatever, sometimes even days, praise the Lord, you know, in those times when I really understand I'm forgiven, what I thought, the tone of the law against me is completely different. Now the tone means the attitude of, tone of a work of literature is the attitude of the author toward the materials. The tone of voice, when I do not understand that I'm forgiven, that the law speaks to me. You know. And when I know I'm forgiven, that same word, law, is a gift. And knowing that, hearing that, it's the difference between night and day in my whole understanding of it. That's why I mentioned this business about this unexpected surprise of when I was married, to be able to have countless relationships with women that were what was advertised by proponents of, you know, sexuality, pre and post and extra and all this. These folks advertised delivering this effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I experienced that effect. Okay, I have better, you know, and we haven't gotten together, you know, the lifestyle, actually, after lifestyle is over and I'm no longer a teacher, like a year later, 2 years later, my goodness, the conversations, you know, bing, 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 much more friends kind of thing, you know. I'm willing to bet that in 6 years, short years, I've had more meaningful heart-to-heart promise, you know, the promise of relationships with women than Don Juan. No, I don't even like Don Juan, because he's obviously, you know, out of sight. I mean, off the stage. But I have no question in my mind. I'm up here in the, you know, at this place, and then talk to these people later, years later, and it's there's no question in my mind that I've had more relationships, deep, meaningful relationships with women, and I've never had intercourse with one.
I heard that, you know,
I don't think that there's you know, from, and I know many, many males in many situations, poets, artistic communities where this is something that's just, you know, this is one out of the beard. I have no question at all from the hundreds of males that I know, but that's Nancy has something. Do you have something?
No, I just want to say that I understood in part what you meant the first time you said that.
Yeah.
But now I understand you were also saying that the law has made you free. Well, the obedience has made you free, right?
Well, you find out that
or
thing
you
that you feared,
yeah,
is a great gift.
Right.
And there's a great freedom involved there.
Yeah.
Freedom in relationship. Insofar as people do not expect any kind of sexual response from me. Wow, the kinds of conversation I can have with those women. But I can meet some students or people who do have that expectancy, even though they don't know me or something. There's the sort of the sexual politics kind of situation. Like going back to St. Olaf, a lot of people didn't know me, and you could, it's almost, anybody's got a little whatever detector, and that stuff goes off. And it's, you almost, the conversation has got to stoop to a certain level in order to make it through and seem friendly, because you can't really have a good meeting of nation, intelligence, heart, guts, passion. Right. Because there's a certain colored glass that the whole thing is seen through. And being obedient to these two things that seem so restricted are great freedom. And this isn't that I'm a poet after all. I'm not just some old stick. You don't write poems for nothing. It isn't that fornication is not something that I have, get 220 volts off my fingers, sometimes. And that didn't end when I was married. That the opportunity and the desire for adultery has been there. But I don't have to. I'm not my Lord. Nancy, did you have?
Yeah, I just think when you've been talking about something I was thinking about in terms of over the last two or three days, too. And that's that one thing I think we face up against, too, first in talking about this in terms of the gospel, is the distinction between pleasure and joy. And I think that that you said that very well in terms of the way your relationship with women, for example, changed when you got married. That is that you entered into joy, And it's from that groundwork that you work now and that you live. And you need not worry about the satisfaction of your drive for pleasure, Because that, there's some of that. There's a distinction there, I think, and a really big one. In Buffon's honeymoon, I start to say a quote for everything. But Lord Peter says, the worst thing passion can commit is to lie down joyless. The worst thing passion can commit is to simply be pleasurable for its own sake. And Thomas Merton tells us that we were created not for pleasure, but for joy. And I think that distinction in terms of this discussion is an important one.
I think it's again that tragedy of man is that he expects to live.
Mm-hmm.
That we actually, almost majority probably of the country, does think that sex can deliver. Mm-hmm. And so their idea, I think people would hold that, their conception of what there is that can be delivered, it's very small. It's a small deliverance and of a brief duration, which does not deny how in our loneliness and self-pity. How much either adultery or extra or premarital sex promises everything. Just everything. And really, we have to have something written on our hearts before we get into those situations. Or it's like, again, the image I used, it's like, this is to changing the image. It's like a coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, 4 feet out over the edge of the cliff. And if we don't have something that keeps us out of certain situations, and not just keeps us out of certain situations, but has us enter into different situations, we might as well be coyote 4 feet out over the edge of the cliff, because there's no, we don't have a chance, snowball chance in hell. We're going to go against that inner man or inner woman. Because I've admitted on everything I've said tonight, 80% of me disagrees. And I don't sit there and have a democratic vote on what do we feel like doing? 1,000 John Grombers inside do not get together and say, what do we feel like doing? Let's have a vote. Because John Grauber isn't Lord. Now, I told Joan that we'd shut the tape off when I shut my mouth. If you guys wanted to do that, because that might be free discussion, do you feel that would be better? There's some people that did want to get in. And I felt like I owed them something said.
John, you talked about being married and you kind of solved the problem of relationships with women and so on.
No.
Yeah, but you said you can
Norman was right about
you
that.
You can have better relationships since you've gotten married than beforehand. Okay, well, most people in this room are single. Well, what is that for that sort of, I think, and I'm going to play devil's advocate and say, you're implying that you either have to get married and so that you can get your source of pleasure and so that you can get this basis of joy so you can go out and have better relationships with other people.
No.
Well, if you're a single person, what are you going to do? Because you can't do that in a non-sinful manner. You can't satisfy your sexual desires without fornication.
Okay. Are you done on that?
I'm raising the question of what does the single person do? And I personally think the single person is able to get into as good a relationships as a married person, and I don't think you have to do it, get married to do that. It's almost like saying, well, if you get married, you're going to have a better life. And I don't think that's true.
I mean, you brought up a lot of things. First, I did not want to imply that the reason that I could have good relationships with many women was dependent upon getting my sexual desires taken care of. The reason that those, in the old days in the locker room, once the pressure was off, then I could relate to people. That is not what I was implying, or intended to imply. By being married, just married, I was outside, or more easily outside, especially if they know the new lease and knew that we were very closely married. I was not being responded to as if there might be a potential sexual relationship around the corner. And because that was, insofar as that was the case, there was a great freedom and access to parts of that woman that are very much deeper than can be reached, that individual woman than can be reached through sex act. It, because the pressure was off, it doesn't have, or that I was sexually satisfied, doesn't have anything to do with that kind of relationship, because one thing, it was what was coming back to me.
But it's the removal of the sexual part of the relationship that allowed you to do that. The expectation of sex.
Yeah. Which would be the case by, with, I think, or more the case rather than less the case between any two people who profess, you know, Christ is Lord and were obedient, and that was part of their code. And they would not have to worry about that. And we're not looking for the other guy to fall or themselves to fall. They could too be free in that way. Because I don't ever stop responding to women out of my sensuality at all, or sexuality. I mean, they clearly are women, and I enjoy that infernal curve put around them by our Creator. But I don't have to pursue. They don't have to feel like I'm pursuing. And there's a great deal of freedom when a woman doesn't have to worry about that.
This is true, and this is what happens when somebody gets married. I know that I get along much better with married women than I do with single women, and it's for the same reason. And I think that there is still that problem of what does the single person do? Because there is that connotation in any relationship, even if you're both Christian, because nobody is perfect, and we're all falling far short, and we're all not following all the rules all of the time, or any of the time for that matter, and no matter how you get around it, there is still that connotation in the relationship, and so I'm asking, what does a single person do?
Well, I guess the way one thing has been said about this, and it sounds corny perhaps, but that when I was in that sense of being married to Christ is our bridegroom, I mean, he is the, we are married to him. And if I know that about someone, and that we share that sort of code of honor, and our honor means something, and that we share that loyalty, and we know that whether we understand it or not, that's, it brings more into the relationship, which hopefully my statement about this might help in that direction. I think that you end up having, you know, you end up, you know, collecting the promised $200 without passing go. When one has that kind of a full intellectual, imaginative, heartfelt relationship with someone, sexuality does not seem to be such a big and necessary part of the relationship. But if that relationship is lacking, then the sex act, of course, you know, takes on huge proportions. And it's asked to deliver things that it just plain can't do. Does that speak to that at all?
But we know that that doesn't work, because
what does?
If that worked, then it would make absolutely no difference whether you were married or not, because there would be no change between the single state and the married state if you had this perfect kind of relationship in Christ between you to start with.
And if you eliminate all homosexual connotations in the first place, then it makes no difference whether you're married or not. And we all know that it does make a difference.
I wasn't a Christian when we got married.
But just from other people that I know who have this same experience, so we were Christians before they got married. After you get married, it does make a difference.
Yeah.
And it just shows that there is this human frailty beforehand, and it's not going to work all the time.
Many times that frailty is from the other side. As soon as I'm married, I'm outside the pale. I'm no longer good. I'm not on the market anymore. And whether anything happens in me, because the thing was that I didn't do anything different than I had ever done. But the relationships with these other women developed a great deal. And that was one of my problems, because I always related with women in a certain way, and it did create problems, because I was very open and unusual in terms of some other guys that they had met. And so there were complications many times, but I just kept doing whatever I was doing. But in the sense that there was not that expectancy, they didn't have to fear anything. They didn't have to hope in any whatever they told them to hope for, and they could relate. Now, I guess it's the proportion. This is one thing I want to stress, that the proportion or the burden that the sex act is asked to carry is impossible. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but wow, it can't deliver. And one other thing at that point, I think it's one reason, and we are democracy under certain definitions is really good, but the democratic urge, it can really get screwed up sometimes. In that the sex act is something any damn fool can do. It gives a feeling of a great deal of relationship, and it doesn't take meeting of mind, meeting of imagination, meeting of heart, meeting of soul, anything. It's something that asks nothing of me that I don't do in my sleep. It's a beautiful celebration of my creatureliness. If this other stuff is there, it is no celebration of my humanity at all. That, I mean, if you have to be interesting with your imagination and your mind and your heart, and with common things, well, then you have a burden of being a person. I was raised to where that wasn't asked at all. You know, I mean, we're in Western Kansas, you know, most of the guys in my high school, you know, in gals, they were, and that's way back in the early 60s, you know, before the pill, but it didn't make that much difference out there. It just doesn't ask.
John?
Yeah.
One thing there that's important, a couple things. One is people getting married mentioning a difference. How surprised we always are if anything God says should happen. Marriage is connected with promise. Either it's a lie or it's true. And the promise is that the two shall be as one flesh. And more importantly, that God blesses marriages. That is either not so or it's so. And I'm not putting it up in a sense of therefore all marriages, you know, are happy. You know, I'm not willing to carry through on that kind of line and put God to the test in that way. But there is a promise connected with it. The other thing is that my mind runs into a sort of say situations my mind keeps coming up with situations which all of us have heard at some point or another, and which at some point or another people are either confused with now or have settled in some fashion for themselves. And I'm thinking of things like the argument, for instance. Two people love each other very much. Who are they hurting? Say, by intercourse outside of marriage. Two people love each other very much. You know, they move in together, unmarried, into an apartment, which under the law cannot be denied in any state. Or you go to jail for refusing to allow people who are not married to live in your apartment, though somebody did in Minneapolis this summer. and I think rightfully not against that law. But those kinds of arguments, those kinds of things that I think I keep thinking of, and I do have things that I respond to those with, and I guess I'm just curious to see what other people say. What do you say to the argument that, who do we hurt? What's wrong with this? I mean, that's usually, you know, or else someone will say, where's the verse? You know, point it out to me, you know. Mm. And the nice thing about the discussion is that it hasn't been on that kind of, you know, the little exchange between John and Keith on the law I thought was very good. It set a different kind of tone. But you know, it's brought up again. In any kind of discussion on sex, someone's going to say, my pastor says that's not true. And I guarantee you that at least 80% of the people in the seminary right now would put their hand on the Bible and tell you that there is nothing wrong with premarital sex. So, I mean, put it in that kind of context, that means that don't expect that, you know, from your pastor, you know, in Sioux Falls, you're going to hear something consistent to what might be discussed here. Your pastor may be wrong. Boy, I remember last year because I got in a big argument at the seminary about this.
I think 80% is a low figure too, Tom.
It's a low figure.
And none of them ever seen a clear dog in the
There's one thing I'd like to say on that is that I think that as Christians we can be chicken shits. We can be intimidated by the world and seek honor of men. I think that the fact that I'd say that probably some of that percentage that at the seminary that feels that way is sincere and misguided, and the other bunch is probably seeking honor of men, because somehow, and I've seen this in pastors too, who would rather be thought of as sophisticated than almost anything. And that's really sad when we're willing to, you know, really give up our inheritance, sell our birthright for a bowl of that soup called, you know, being a knowing chap in the world. And that's, I guess, one reason why I emphasize some things. And I in my own life, I hate to talk too much about myself, and I do probably, but I don't think all on the world's terms I'm damn sophisticated. And I pray that I go through that sophistication to the new naivete, as Becker talks about. And I seek, and in a sense, to having Christ as Lord frees me to gain more sophistication than the so-called sophisticated person can have. Because I'm forgiven. I can think of the implications of it. Or they'd rather keep talking about it, you know, that kind of thing. and I don't think we should be intimidated by all those fancy arguments that and those looks that you get when you say something like fornication. I mean, I could walk in, you know. I mean, I could, you know, how well would I make it at seminary? You know. I mean, I could say how well could they make it in any rhetoric class that I would teach too. And unfortunately, the entrance requirements are not that difficult. Many of the people who go to seminary.
They tell you that you are a threatening personality.
But they.
They tell that to dope yourself to leave.
Well, one thing I have to go because I did promise Elise that I was going to be 1 hour and I've got about 1 to 60 seconds. And say something about that question that Tom brought up, and then I've got to go. But boy, don't you guys go. Keep talking about this. Somehow. There was a time in my life, and even now I get caught in it sometimes, that if I feel that I can show that something is beautiful or worthwhile in the world's terms or in any terms, that then it must be right. And that it is certainly, it could not be something that could cause problems for God, or between God and my relationship. Well, we aren't tempted by ugly things. We're tempted by things that are beautiful. We're tempted to buy things that are exciting. You got to be really sick to be tempted to go get raped. It isn't. You say, "Oh, I haven't met a Don Juan, and I have, you know, that kind of thing." Of course, it isn't. It's Sunday school superintendents. It's not Don Juan that you're going to meet. It's people like me and people like you. Who have, it's actually the more love of the other person that's there, and the more selflessness involved in the relationship, the more credentials that love has to be a rival of God, the allegiance of God. It's, here, look at all these reasons why, you know. Well, that you're showing that is something that is in a position to rival God. It's not ugly things that are in a position to rival God, and we aren't tempted by ugly things. We aren't tempted like by things that aren't supported by a whole bunch of arguments. You know, we're tempted by things that have lots of arguments, and we're tempted by things that are beautiful, and tempted by things that are pleasurable, and tempted by things that are exciting. Tempted by things that are meaningful. Meaningless, dull. Been tempted to be bored lately? Dear God, I've been good today. You know, I was tempted by boredom and I went out and did something interesting. But the thing is, we somehow get in our heads that those temptations are going to be ugly. And it is just insofar as they are beautiful that they are in a position to rival the love that we should have for God. And that is one of the themes of the Four Loves by C.S. Lewis. And it's something that, darn it, we forget so often. We feel somehow if we can give the argument that we've shown the argument for, that we've shown anything, but that this is a larger rival to God rather than a smaller one. And still, there is the promise that when we know we are forgiven, part of the promise is what we knew as the law before. And that's why I don't want to denigrate and only talk about low-life forms of this stuff. It is two beautiful people. Intelligent, sharp, thoughtful, selfless in many ways. Love, you know, and the love is very selfless. And the height of, you know, it's sort of the picture book love. You know. That's where these, that's where we see the cost of discipleship, which ends up being gain, if we follow. Well, those are just a lot of things to talk through. And boy, do it, and I'm leaving town, but keep this up. I think it's important that you talk about this more. Because even though I might have this in my head, I have to speak the language of the world. That's a weight of glory, as Lewis called it. I have to learn the language of the world and be able to talk to people without who do not accept revelation, and to talk to this in their language without reference to them, but inside my own head. I have to refer to revelation and the promise to even open my mouth, but to talk to them and to try to think through some of these things and talk about things like what happened to me when I, the discovery I made when I was married. Now that's no reference to revelation, but it's an exciting gift. That's something that can be talked about. We do have to practice that. And one thing I've always laughed here at Holden is, you know, outside it's known you can't talk about sex, religion, or politics. And boy, we should be able to talk about those things here. And argue those things, too. But those are subjects that are very suited to this place. Anyway, I gotta go and keep this going because it's important. And man, it's the forces, you know, against what I've said. When 80 or 90% of the seminary believes otherwise, it's significant. You know, you are in the front line of the kingdom. You really are. Good night.
Sleep tight.